Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The defense team in the trial of admitted Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev rested just moments ago after calling their fourth and final witness. Closing statements are planned for Monday.
It was a very brief defense, lasting only a day and a half, compared to the prosecution's case, which included 92 witnesses over 15 days of testimony.
Tsarnaev's defense team highlighted digital and forensic evidence today, apparently continuing their efforts to focus the jury on their argument that Tsarnaev's elder brother Tamerlan was the driving force behind the bombing. Joining us now with more is WBUR's Jack Lepiarz, who's at the Moakley Federal Courthouse in South Boston. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi there. So tell us a little bit more about this evidence that the defense presented today. What did jurors see?
Well, today it was a lot of computer forensics and a lot of fingerprint analysis. Let's start with the computer forensics. What the defense established essentially is that the extremist Islamic materials, namely Inspire magazine and the article on how to build a homemade bomb, originated on a computer owned by Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother. And so by going through the records, they showed that a thumb drive was plugged into Tamerlan's laptop and that the Inspire magazine file was then copied to that thumb drive. About 2 minutes later, after the file's copied to the thumb drive, it suddenly appears on Jahar Tsarnaev's computer. The defense in this process essentially showing it was not Jahar Tsarnaev who sought out these materials. It was his older brother, Tamerlan, saying, hey, take a look at this, and then copying it onto his computer. As far as the fingerprint analysis, we saw a lot of various tools and possibly materials that could have been used to build the bombs. All of those materials had only Tamerlan Tsarnaev's fingerprints on them. Jahar's fingerprints were not on any of them. There was one moment, a Tupperware bomb filled with about 2 pounds, maybe 3 pounds of black powder taken from the stolen Mercedes SUV. That had two of Jahar Tsarnaev's fingerprints on it, but six of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's fingerprints on it. Along the Marathon explosions themselves, 500 items were tested for prints. Only two prints came back on pieces of cardboard that were inside the pressure cookers. Two prints were lifted from that. Both of them belonged to Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
I see. So a lot of evidence being presented by the defense that once again points, they say, towards Tamerlan Tsarnaev's alleged leadership in this plan. Did prosecutors respond in any way? They had the opportunity to cross-examine some of these witnesses.
Yeah. The prosecution scored some points, at least on the fingerprint analysis, pointing out that when you have a situation like an explosion, a lot of these fingerprints are going to get wiped off. Remember, fingerprints are essentially sweat from your hand or oil from your hand, and it's very fragile. I mean, it can be wiped off with a napkin, much less an explosion where you've got temperatures in the hundreds of degrees. So that's a circumstance, and it would speak to, again, why out of 500 items tested from along that route, you only got two fingerprints. On the computer forensics, the argument was a point they've made before, getting the witness to testify. No, you don't exactly know who is at the computer, who's using the computer at any given point. You can tell, as a general rule, who the computer belongs to, but they pointed out that Jahar Tsarnaev had logged on to his email on Tamerlan Tsarnaev's computer at least once, so you don't know for sure that it was Tamerlan and not Jahar who downloaded these materials.
WBUR's Jack Lepiarz at the Moakley Federal Courthouse. Thanks as always, Jack.
You're welcome.
And joining us now to offer some analysis is Ron Sullivan. He's a professor at Harvard Law School and director of the Criminal Justice Institute there. And Ron Sullivan, welcome to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
So I'd like to ask you about today, first of all, the defense resting its case. As we heard, they called just four witnesses over a day and a half. By contrast, the prosecution, 92 witnesses over 15 days of testimony. What have you made of this trial so far?
Well, the prosecution has done an excellent job in terms of presenting a solid case So much so that from the very beginning, liability has never really been an issue here. As your correspondent pointed out, all that's really at issue here is what's going to happen in the punishment phase, and that's what the defense has geared its presentation toward.
Is it anything surprise you at all about the approach the defense team has taken? I mean, very brief, laying out the case, their case very briefly over the last day and a half. Looks like they're saving their powder for the sentencing phase, I guess.
Yeah, so not at all. It hasn't surprised me a bit. The defense, I think, very strategically used the witnesses it had to preview what its case is going to be at the sentencing stage. What it wants to do is say, yes, absolutely, our client is guilty. Our client should be punished. But it's a question of degree, given that the major instigator of the case was Tamberlin, the older brother. The question for the jury is going to be whether the younger brother actually deserves the ultimate, most severe penalty that our law permits, and that's death. Defense is going to say, no, he was bad, he should be punished, he should be in jail for the rest of his life, but he shouldn't die.
And is there a precedent for juries in cases like this, not giving the death penalty?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's why we have the bifurcated trial. So even though a jury is death qualified, that means that they can and are willing to give the death penalty, but it doesn't mean that they must give the death penalty. Our law rests that discretion with the jury, and it's an incredible burden for a jury to shoulder. Essentially, they're checking a box at the end of the penalty phase, and if that box says death, then they are in fact precipitating the death of a fellow human being. It's an awesome burden for any juror to carry, and they take that burden very seriously, and they are assiduous in exercising their duty. So it's going to be a tough sale, I think.
Yeah, and if you were to I don't know, place a wager on the outcome of this trial, I mean, do you imagine that this jury will choose the death penalty, or what's your best guess?
Well, you know, there's a reason I'm a law professor and not a wealthy gambler in Las Vegas, so I'm not a good wagerer. But if forced to do so, given that we are in Massachusetts and there's a general displeasure with the death penalty, I would say that this jury probably will not come back with death. I should point out that they only need one juror. So when I say this jury, they only need one dissenter. And given that the defense has done, I think, a good job in showing that the older brother was the prime mover in this situation, if I were to guess, I would say life in prison.
Yeah. It seems like the defense needs to walk a careful line here, though. I mean, on the one hand, saying he did it, but on the other hand, making a case that Jahar Tsarnaev was under the sway of an older brother who masterminded the crime. Is there a risk that that argument could backfire because of that thin line between explaining and potentially coming off like you're excusing?
Oh, absolutely. And the defense walks that tightrope every day. And that's the worst thing that you can get the jury to thinking, that you're trying to justify or excuse the actions. Now, luckily for the defendant, he has an absolutely stellar grade A defense team. So they've walked this line before. But as you point out, it is a perilous tightrope. So, and there's no magic calculus as to what's too much and what's just the right amount. But you're right; they have to be very, very careful.
Sure. And finally, as we move into this penalty phase of this trial, what are you going to be looking for, watching for?
So, what the prosecution is going to try to do is to convey to the jury that whatever role Mr. Tsarnaev played in the bombing, he is liable to the same degree as his brother. They're going to remind the jury that at the beginning they took a solemn oath that they would listen to the evidence, and if the evidence warranted, that they were ready, willing, and able to give the death penalty. They're going to remind the jury of that and ask for a return of a death verdict. The defense, on the other hand, is going to say, look, criminal law is all about apportionment of blame. It's about whether conduct is sufficiently blameworthy to merit some punishment. And they're going to look the jury in the eye and say, ladies and gentlemen, he was blameworthy, but his degree of blameworthiness does not warrant the most severe penalty our law has. So that's how it's going to turn out, and we'll see what the jury does.
All right, we will indeed. Ron Sullivan is a professor at Harvard Law School and director of the Criminal Justice Institute. Thank you very much, Professor Sullivan. We appreciate it.
Many thanks. Take care.
Well, stick with us, because coming up, Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg joins us to talk Olympics, the MBTA, and state budget challenges. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.